Seeing Spencer Tracy act is like watching Picasso paint or watching Willie Mays catch a fly ball. They make it look so easy, you think, I can do that too. I can act like Spencer Tracy, but you can't. For me, nobody ever could.
You're out!
The way I see it, Spencer Tracy was absolutely the greatest film actor of the 20th century. Tracy could do it all. If Jimmy Stewart was every man, then Spencer Tracy was the universal man. He could play any character, any IQ. Look at him in Captain's Courageous. He's a fisherman, a wonderful fisherman, but with zero education.
Gosh, can I take him off the hook?
We got no time for that. We don't know these fish personal.
Now watch the same actor play Thomas Edison with a genius that very few actors possess.
If we could find a light without a flame that you could put into homes where men and women are ruining their eyesight under oil lamps, people everywhere could have a safer and a brighter light.
It's no wonder, along with Miss Hepburn, we all fell in love with him.
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and I know I say that every show is special, and they are in their own way, but this one really is because it is the first of a two-part podcast network crossover with Two True Freaks' Is It Jaws, which means, of course, my co-host is, for this time, Paul Spataro. Hello, Paul. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. I'm very happy to be back, and I'm happy that we are finally doing a crossover, which we've been talking about doing, kind of forever.
A long time. This is a Crisis on Earth Tracy, in that we are going to be, not Darlin' Tracy, in this case it's Spencer Tracy. We are going to be talking about a Spencer Tracy movie, namely 1939's Stanley and Livingstone, and then I will be appearing on Paul's show, Is It Jaws, to talk about 1958? Is it 56's? I forget what year that movie came out.
I'll tell you in 1 second. It is 1955.
55, I was off. 1955's Bad Day at Black Rock, so it's going to be a lot of fun. So we've been talking about doing a crossover for a while, and now we're finally getting a chance to do it, and we're talking about one of my favorite actors of all time. But before we get to all that, I want to ask you, Paul, like, what was your... Why did you want to do this necessarily? I mean, I sort of turned it into a two-parter, but you were the one who approached me about doing Bad Day at Black Rock. So, what is it? Are you a fan of Spencer Tracy in particular?
I don't think I'm as much of a fan as you are. I have everything I've ever seen Spencer Tracy in, I've enjoyed. So, does that make me a fan? I guess it does. My biggest thing for him was always It's a Mad World.
Sure.
Which really doesn't showcase his acting talent
the way a lot of other things do. Spencer Tracy movie.
But, I have seen him in various things over the years, and I've always thought he was really good in them. And I always kind of like that he isn't your prototypical leading man. You know, he looks a little different. He looks more like a common man. He doesn't, he doesn't have necessarily the movie star look. And there's something about the way he delivers a line. There's a certain earnestness that's always there. So to that extent, I guess I am a fan, but I'm not a fan where I've sought out a lot of his stuff in the past. I just kind of whatever came across, I would watch. And I would always enjoy it. But I was never, there's certain actors in the past where I remember, like, when video stores first became big, I would go and I would just say, I haven't seen this Humphrey Bogart movie. Let me take this out. I haven't seen this one. And I would just go on a kick with particular actors. Spencer Tracy was never that. This particular movie, Bad Day at Black Rock, which is what instigated this particular crossover. I remember that back when Siskel and Ebert... I think it was at the movies at the time, because they first started with sneak previews and then they graduated to at the movies. And at the end of the show, they used to say, here's a movie from the past that we're going to recommend. And they recommended Bad Day at Black Rock, and they showed a little clip from it, and they talked about it, and they said how highly regarded it was in their opinions. And it kind of stayed with me that I always wanted to see it, and I never got around to it. And then I saw it was going to be on Turner Classic Movies one day, so I set the DVR for it. And then the afternoon that I was finally, I made the time to sit down and watch it. As I was watching it, I thought to myself, I don't know exactly why, but I thought to myself, Rob would like this movie. And I texted you and said, do you have any interest in coming on Is It Yours to discuss Bad Day at Black Rock? And you came back and said, you know, Spencer Tracy's one of my all-time favorites. Absolutely, I'd like to do it. And then we came up with the idea of the crossover. And then I'm going to take the blame, sort of, on that because, you know, you asked if there was another Spencer Tracy movie I'd be interested in doing. I knew you already covered It's a Mad World because I listened to that episode. And I happened to have a copy of Stanley and Livingston in my collection and had never seen it. So I decided this was a good opportunity to see this movie if you were able to get a copy and watch it as well, which you were.
Yeah, my library had it, luckily. It's a very kind of like, you know, learny type movie. It's a good movie for a library to have.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with that. But it's really, you know, we're doing a crossover with two movies, neither of which I had ever seen before, and both of which, you know, was kind of like, let me give a shot because these are movies I've heard of with an actor who I respect. And just catching my eye, I have the Wikipedia page open on my computer, and I just find it interesting that the movie poster for Stanley and Livingston, underneath the title, it has the actors. So the first name under it is Tracy, and the second name under it is Kelly.
It worked out that way. Yeah, it's funny what you mentioned about video stores, because that was actually how I discovered Spencer Tracy. Is that, and I've mentioned this on other episodes, is the video store that I worked at had a section called Hollywood's Best, which was where they grouped movies by star. So it was like Betty Davis, Humphrey Bogart, Elvis Presley, Jack Nicholson, and Spencer Tracy. And that was when I was like, well, I'm just going to rent as many movies as I can because they were free. So I'm just going to watch as much as I can. I was living at home. You know, I had all money to, you know, it was like I had nothing else to do. So why not just watch movies? And Spencer Tracy, because of it, was the mad world. That was my intro. And then I discovered how much I liked this guy, especially later Spencer Tracy, where he's old and grizzled, and he's this kind of paragon of virtue. He kind of plays the same character in almost every movie, and that he's except, of course, It's a Mad World. But in almost all his other movies, he's this sort of rock of moral certitude. And I really liked that about him. And then I went back and started watching the older films. And the two films we're going to talk about do cover two different eras of his acting career, because in Bad Day at Black Rock, that's him as sort of the, again, that pillar of moral certitude. But in this era, 1939, this is where he's playing like the great men, you know, the great men of history. And in this case, he is playing the reporter Henry M. Stanley, who was sent to Africa to find the missing Dr. Livingston. And that's, you know, Livingstone, I presume, is like one of the phrases that you just learn in the culture. As you grow up, you know, you learn a little bit about it in school, you Stanley Livingstone and stuff like that. So I don't think I knew anything about the story until I first saw the movie many, many years ago. And then I have not seen it since until I rewatched it for this show. The film is, again, it's from 1939. It's directed by Henry King, who had a really great career. He directed 12 O'Clock High and a lot of other really great movies. So, I mean, this was one of the any of the films that he did. It co-stars Nancy Kelly, as you mentioned, Kelly, Richard Green, Walter Brennan, Charles Coburn, Cedric Hardwick as Dr. Livingston, Henry Hall, Henry Travers from The Invisible Man, Miles Mander, David Torrance, a lot of old-timey sort of silent actors. And they said the film opens with Spencer Tracy as Stanley, and they're showing him off as like this great adventurer. He's out there on his horse, and there's this whole bit about, oh, there's no way any man could make it through this valley, and here comes Stanley on his horse. So it's like, he's like Indiana Jones, like this grand adventurer kind of guy. Were you familiar at all with, like, the real-life versions of these guys? Because I didn't know them at all until I saw the movie, other than the Livingstone, I presume. That's like all I knew about them.
Yeah, I knew that. And I mean, I knew that that Livingstone was I'm tempted to say mercenary, but missionary. God, thank you. But that he was a missionary in Africa. But I really didn't know much more than that, other than, you know, kind of the basic strokes that he was thought to be lost and that this person went to find him. I didn't even know that he was a reporter. I just knew that he went on an adventure to find him, and obviously eventually found him. And that's where the Livingston, I presume, comes from.
Right.
But I really didn't know the story, and I always question whenever we're dealing, especially with the older movies where they tend to glamorize things a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
I always tend to question, you know, the historical accuracy of these movies. Even on the more modern ones, I question it, but they're not adverse to showing, you know, negative things in the more modern ones. And that was one of the things that jumped out at me in this was, you know, they're trying to show you how this is a mission that, you know, very, very few people could even survive, and that they were losing people along the way to the various diseases and perils along the way. And yet, every shot they showed of Spencer Tracy, he still had his hat on nice and neat and his marching gear on. And he didn't look any worse for the wear until we got really, really close to the actual meeting of the two people. And that's, I guess that's more like an old-time thing, that in these movies they really didn't do squalor well.
Right. Everything's just, yeah, this was made by MGM, and everything from MGM had a certain sheen to it, no matter, you know, even if except the idea that Henry Stanley is out there having adventures, and he's probably not showering, and he's not shaving, but yet he still looks recognizably like Spencer Tracy. You know, they're not going to, like, dirty him up too far. I do love the opening of this movie where he talks to his editor, James Gordon Bennett Jr., who's played by Henry Hull, who was in Werewolf of London. That's probably the film I'm most familiar with him from. And The Office that his editor has is amazing. This is when, like, guys that ran newspapers were, like, captains of industry, because The Office looks like Wayne Manor. You know, it's, yes, like, beyond huge. And when you watch the scene, I mean, they actually spend a good amount of time with the setup, explaining why he's going to go look for Livingston and, you know, how he's going to, like, they're going to, he's going to, how much money it's going to cost and all these other kind of things. And it makes me think that, at the very least, Steven Spielberg and George Lucas saw this and thought about it when it came time to do Raiders of the Lost Ark. Because it has that feel to it. Like, it's, you know, it's Marcus Brody and Indy, and they're, you know, setting up the adventure.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned Indiana Jones early on, and I had not considered that watching this, which now I'm saying, boy, how could I not think of that? I mean, it is such an obvious parallel. And I, you know, we do know Spielberg and Lucas love the old movies, so... Yeah. To think that this didn't influence them in some way is probably silly.
Right. And so they, you know, Henry Stanley goes out with the adventure. He boards a boat on a way to Africa, and that's when he meets the rival paper run by Charles Coburn, this Lord Tice guy. And Charles Coburn, another guy that's been in like 40,000 movies, he doesn't make the greatest impression when he meets Lord Tice on the boat. He does befriend Walter Brennan, who is kind of the comic relief in this movie.
But Walter Brennan's at his side in the initial scene as
That's right. You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's correct.
And it's, you know, I find it interesting that Walter Brennan's in both of our movies here. And I wonder how many of Spencer Tracy, like, was Walter Brennan part of the Spencer Tracy troupe? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Walter Brennan's one of the, I think he has like a couple of hundred credits. So he's just a guy who was constantly working. So anyway, Stanley eventually, on the boat trip, makes over to Zanzibar. He makes an unfavorable impression on Lord Tice. He meets Eve Kingsley, played by Nancy Kelly, and her father, John Kingsley, played by Henry Travers, the temporary head of the British authorities in Zanzibar. Eve has been seeing Gareth Tice recovering from his ordeal in hopes of getting him to persuade his father to use his influence to have her father reassigned to a more healthy posting back in England. Eve warns Stanley about the dangers of Africa, but he is undeterred.
I have a tough time seeing Henry Travers and not thinking of Clarence.
That's right, yeah.
it really is difficult for me to see, because that's constantly what comes to mind. And then I have no idea how old he was when they made this movie, but... she points out to Spencer Tracy that he's only 50 when they see him, because, you know, mm-hmm. he's like, oh, he looks all right. And he's like, well, he's only 50 years old. And you know, then you're amazed. So I'm just curious now. Henry Travers was born in 1874. So he would have been in his 60s when this was made.
He's living a hard life, that guy.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the message they're trying to give you. Yeah, it was interesting. I thought the relationship between Stanley and Lord Tice, in that he immediately, you know, gets in disfavor with him because he questions the results of Gareth Tice's expedition to find Livingston, and Gareth Tice had come to the conclusion that Livingston was gone; he was deceased, and Stan Lee doesn't accept that, and Lord Tice is immediately offended and going to oppose Stan Lee in everything that he does. And I think it's real interesting, though, that as the movie goes on, not only does he fall in love with Eve Kingsley, but he develops a very strong respect relationship with Gareth Tice, despite his father's hatred for him.
Right.
And I just thought that was a real cool dynamic in this movie. And, you know, I talked about how the earlier movies would tend to kind of glamorize things to some extent. They also would tend to be a lot more black and white as far as who the good guys were and who the bad guys were. And putting a little bit more of a shade of gray into their relationship is, I thought, you know, shows a little bit of depth that I didn't quite expect to see in the movie.
Hmm. Yeah, the whole romance angle where Henry is falling for Eve Kingsley played by Nancy Kelly, that part felt a little tacked, not a little, I felt a lot sort of tacked on. Like, I don't feel like you needed it. Now, I know that in these old-timey movies, they felt like you kind of had to, but I thought it was sort of unnecessary. I didn't need to see Henry Stanley fall in love. I just wanted to see him go on the adventure. I was perfectly happy. And they don't even really do a whole lot with it because it's almost entirely unrequited. Every time Henry sees Eve, they play that music, string music starts to play, and he gets all googly-eyed at her. but Nancy Kelly never has any other thing but eyes for Richard Green. And apparently that part, Gareth Tice, was originally supposed to be played by Tyrone Power. They were offered it to him, which would have been even more ridiculous because no woman is picking Spencer Tracy over Tyrone Power. I mean, he's like one of the best-looking guys like to ever walk the planet.
But I think they do. I'm not really that familiar with Nancy Kelly, but I thought she did a pretty good job of showing that she did have feelings for him, but understood it was never going to go anywhere and just kind of let it go, especially in that final scene that they have together.
Right. I mean, I guess the movie itself doesn't indicate that she's really ever going to flip for, you know, she's going to leave Gareth.
And it's just as well that they don't, because, you know, ultimately the story. Spoilers for a movie made from 1939 for everybody. at the end of the movie, Stanley learns that Livingston has now passed away, and he goes back to Africa to continue his missionary work there. So he's ultimately going to leave Eve Kingsley, who is now married to Gareth Tice by the end of the movie anyway. But you do see that there is that relationship, and he does give her a somewhat passionate kiss at the end. For the time. 1939 movie, that was a passionate kiss.
Yeah. All the adventure stuff, I actually think is pretty good. There was a whole lot of second unit footage shot by somebody else named Otto Brauer. That's why if you go to IMDb, it'll actually list both of them as the director, even though Otto Brauer basically just shot this footage independently of the movie. And they do pretty good back projection work. I think it looks, you know, for 1939 level effects, I think it's pretty well handled. We see Spencer Tracy walking through the foreground and all the, you know, the plants and all the stuff they stick in front of him. It looks pretty plausible, like he was actually out there. So nice job on the special effects team. It's a good process work.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a pretty clean movie considering, you know, the time it was made. I was impressed with the gravitas, if that's a good word for it, that Cedric Hardwick had as Dr. Livingston in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he did, you know, he had just a weight to him, you know, and a seriousness that it was believable that he pulled in Stanley and that he was, you know, just charismatic enough to get his message across. And talking about these, you know, these basically cannibals that he's taught, you know, to be behaving in a civilized manner. And, you know, when Stanley comes, you know, the idea is, oh, I'm going to make you famous. And Livingston's response is, I don't want to be famous. I thought you were coming to help me, because his mission is what was important to him.
Yeah, I did a little reading about it to see, you know, how glossed over that was, because I'm always a little hesitant when you see old movies where it's like, oh, the white man is going to come and show all these non-white people the way how to be. You're like, oh boy. But it sounds, you know, records vary. Wikipedia mentions a few things about how that Livingstone, you know, was there to really try and help these people and bring medicine and stuff like that. And also he was definitely big against the slave trade. That was one of his big things, because there was a lot of that going on over there. But then I read other things that say that as much as he was against the slave trade, he also benefited from it in certain regards. So the judgment is kind of out a little on how much Livingston was good for the people out there. And you mentioned the ending about where Stan Lee decides to go back and finish the work. That's the big whopper of this movie, because Stan Lee didn't do that. Stan Lee did not return to Africa to continue the work. He did it to build an empire, to continue building an empire, and basically build like the legend of Livingston. So that he was not drawn in by the work necessarily. But, you know, these are...
You just ruined the whole movie, man.
Oh, I'm sorry. But this is, you know, these are big, you know, this is a big glossy take on this thing. It's kind of funny when you think about that, you know, when they made this movie, that like all these people were not still alive, but they were fresh within people's memories. You know, like to us, Stanley Livingston are these figures from ancient history. And yet when
they
made
close to 150 years ago now.
Yeah, and yet when they made this movie, I mean, like, you know, Henry Stanley and Spencer Tracy overlapped. You know, they existed on Earth at the same time. And that's kind of an amazing thing. You think that these, you know, titanic figures of history were relatively accessible. It kind of reminds me about like that Wyatt Earp, one of those guys, like lived long enough to consult on movies that they made about him. Like it's unbelievable when you think about that.
It is amazing. It really is. Well, I guess it, I mean, time wise, it would be similar to making a movie now about something that occurred in 1950.
Right. Right, you would still have some of these people that are still around. It's remarkable, and I have to wonder, like Spencer Tracy, how much research could he do? He probably could have talked to at least the family members about this kind of stuff. I mean, the Spencer Tracy persona, I would say, is not yet fully formed. He had already won his two Oscars by this point. He won two Oscars back to back. For Captain's Courageous and for Boys Town. This was the first film he did after Boys Town. So his persona was forming, but it wasn't totally there yet, because he's more he's sarcastic in this film, but he's a little more gullible is not the term, but just a little more wide-eyed than in some of his films he would do immediately after this. And the big scene, the famous scene that Dr. Livingston, I presume, I like the way he plays it, and he sort of underplays it. He asks, like, question.
He looks like he's a little intimidated.
Yes.
Which, considering the bigger-than-life character that he's playing, that's an impressive moment for him to be at all intimidated. I don't even know if intimidated is the right word. Maybe just, like, very, very impressed.
Right. I mean, you have to imagine that this guy that you think is maybe even dead, and there he is in the flesh, you know, and he's alive and he's doing all these things. And again, Cedric Hardwick was, you know, a big famous actor. And so, yeah, the take he does of it is really good. And I did read some things about that he tried different ways, like consulted different ways of doing it. And I've read books on Spencer Tracy where they've talked about him making this movie. And said he is, I mean, Cedric Hardwick, for the film to be called Stanley and Livingston, you would think it's about both of them, but it really isn't. Livingston really doesn't figure in that much in the movie. It really is the story of Henry Stanley and his adventures. And, you know, Tracy is in virtually every scene. There's a scene where he has a dream. There's like a fever dream sequence where they have this really great voiceover. That's well done. And that's all just on Tracy. Big close-up on Tracy having to sell that. And it said there's a reason why he became one of the biggest movie stars there ever was, because he just knew how he was just able to draw you in whatever character he was playing.
Yeah, he was. But again, like I had said earlier, though, I never saw him as the quintessential Hollywood actor.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could say he's the quintessential actor, but not Hollywood. He just didn't have the look of a Hollywood guy.
Certainly not. Certainly not.
And I think by breaking that mold, it created just. It made him more compelling in his own way. And I agree with you, though, that you know, most of my memories of him are the crotchety old Spencer Tracy.
Right.
Or older. I think he always looked older than he was.
Yeah, he always looked... I mean, he drank, you know, a lot. So I think he aged... Much like we were talking about with Henry Travers, I think Spencer Tracy aged himself a lot faster than was really necessary. I mean, he had white hair pretty early on. He didn't treat himself terribly well, and I think that helped later on. And then when they purposely, I think in later films like Inherit the Wind and Judgment at Nuremberg, they went for the, that creased face look that he had, those big deep lines where he looked like he was made of stone or something. I think they went for that. Here, he's still young and sort of fresh looking and again, wide-eyed and things like that. And instead, it's a really good performance. I think the film, I was paying attention to this because I read about it before I watched it. This film was edited by Barbara McLean, who was one of the first female film editors. She was really like a pioneer. She worked on a bunch of great films with Henry King, the director. She worked with him a lot, including 12 O'Clock High, which I mentioned. But she also edited All About Eve, which is a huge film, and Nightmare Alley with Tyrone Power, which was a movie that I actually covered here on the show previously. So she was terrific, and I think this is a fairly tight movie. This movie is an hour and 40 minutes, and considering how much of a sprawling story it is, how many locations it has, that's actually pretty tight. I could definitely see a movie. I think if they made this nowadays, this would be like 2.5 hours. But an hour and 40, that's a pretty well, you know, it moves at a good clip.
Yeah, it does, and it covers a lot of ground. So it's for a movie that has a lot of shots of people marching along the Serengeti, it's a fairly quick paced movie.
Yeah.
Although I don't know that it's Serengeti, but whatever. It's just, that's an Africa term, so it sounds good.
Close enough. Yeah. It's a good movie. It's not when I watched it the first time. 25 years ago, I remember thinking it was pretty good, but I did sort of. It's not one of my Spencer Tracy favorites or anything like that, it's a solid movie. And I said when you look at the cast that they arranged, the supporting actors, I mean, these are all like legendary guys. Again, I mentioned Walter Brennan, Charles Coburn, Cedric Hardwick, Henry Hall, Henry Travers. These guys combined have like 1,000 movies to their credit. You know, they were just plugging these guys in left and right. And again, Spencer Tracy would go on to do even tons more movies, but it's a good movie. I think it probably. Do you think do you think a kid would want to sit through this? Do you think it's a little too dry, or like maybe a younger kid?
How do you define a kid? Because when you say a kid, I'm thinking you.
Oh well, yeah, thank you. No, if you had an 8 or 9 year old who was interested in history, do you think this would hold their interest, or do you think it's just a little too? You know,
I think you might have to tie them down to the chair to get them to give it a shot.
Okay.
Because they'd be too busy wanting to play video games or watch cartoons.
Put your phone down.
If you took a kid in school and, you know, in a history class they wanted to teach about Stanley and Livingston, and the teacher, you know, put this movie on, I think it would eventually pull in their attention and they'd be enjoying it.
Mm.
But I think getting them to sit down in the first place would be the hard thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Hollywood has never, of course, given up the notion of doing these people going into the jungle movies. I mean, just last year, The Lost City of Z came out which was about that, based on a real story about an explorer from around 1910, 1920, going into the deep jungle and looking for these lost tribes of people. So it's a story that is always going to be appealing. Because you like to think that the world isn't so big that there isn't some part that's still unmapped and uncharted. So, I mean, I could see why you wouldn't want to remake Stanley Livingston, because I do think there is, you know, we've all gotten a little wiser. And we realize, you know, it's a little dodgy to necessarily be talking about the Great White Hope going into these countries and teaching them what's what. But the idea of having these adventures and going into some lost place is never going to go out of style, because it's always just sort of like, you know, the mystery and the romance of it.
Exactly. I think it's the kind of thing that, you know, even those of us who don't really seek out adventure to speak of still kind of have this fantasy in our minds that we could be an adventure seeker. And it's just as well to live vicariously through our film stars, because we know we're never going to do it. I don't even want to go camping, for God's sake.
Yeah, this doesn't look like fun to me at all.
But the idea of being Indiana Jones, because I'll always go to him as the quintessential adventurer, that's an exciting fantasy for anybody. So if you can sit and watch these things in the movies, you know, in the safety of a movie seat, especially now with a nice recliner, it's the perfect way to be an adventurer. And I definitely think it'll never go out of style.
What do you think about the movie's, the final act, the scene in the courtroom? What do you think about that? Because I read some criticisms of it saying that it's kind of unnecessary that you really, because it's, we know that Livingston is alive. We know that Henry's men, and yet we have to go through all this stuff where you have all these guys in their monocles fumfering around telling Stanley that he's wrong and that he's lying. It's a little like, it feels, I saw some reviews that said it was really kind of a way just to keep Spencer Tracy in the story when he really isn't necessary.
I can see that
a little bit.
I understand the argument, but I disagree with it. I think it's a good scene because there is a little, by the time you get to that scene, I think you have a little bit of an emotional connection with Stanley and what he went through. Mm. Even though, like I said, I thought they Hollywoodized some of the journey. By the end of it, I think you do see, you know, the scene you talked about where he was having the fever dreams, and even at the time, you know, with Livingston, I think now you've committed and you're part of this expedition by the time you get to that. So now when he gets back, and first of all, you know, they're really setting up Lord Tice as the villain at that point.
Yeah.
Because he's the one who's spearheading the criticism and the reasons to not believe what Stanley is saying. You know, I think it's setting up the battle between those two. The only thing about the scene that I really didn't like so much is this, just the timing of it, where the information comes in as he's walking out that mm-hmm. all of a sudden they change their minds or whatever. I think it probably would have just felt more real if he had left and maybe a week had gone by and then the message comes in about, you know, Livingston's death and, you know, his note and everything. And then they come to him with their apologies. I think it would have had a little bit more of a real feel to it then. I assume most of this is Hollywoodized and made up anyway. I can't imagine that it happened exactly.
Yeah, I assume so.
So if you're going to make it up, you might as well make it up in a little bit more believable way. And I think it would carry more weight if you have him walk out of the room totally dejected because all his efforts are not being rewarded. He didn't go on the trip to become a missionary. He didn't go on there. He went for the fame and glory, really. And now he's being denied that. And maybe you have a little scene there. You know, it is a fairly short movie at 101 minutes, so you could add another 5 minutes to it where maybe he's dejected by the ruling of the council and then sees the greater good of what he did anyway, and then he gets vindicated. I think it would have carried a little bit more weight that way.
Yeah, I can see that.
But I do like that they questioned his findings.
Mm-hmm.
That they didn't just accept him. And I thought about that as the scene was on, thinking back in those days, there would be so little documentation and so little actual proof that what he did was real. You know, he couldn't just bring, you know, his iPhone and say, here's footage of Livingston, you know?
I already know. You go to my YouTube channel, guys. Check it out.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought about it, and I started thinking, well, boy, how do you prove that you were there? I mean, I guess, you know, they even in 1870, they did have photography equipment, but I don't know if they would have brought any with them.
Right, yeah, I think we see that they're traveling pretty light, obviously, because you're going that far deep into the bush. You really just need to bring, you know, water and provisions. Yeah.
Yeah. So when he gets back, what is there other than his word and his descriptions, and, you know, he brought back maps. And some of that was, like, you know, clearly there was a bias or a desire to not believe him. They would, you know, and I think it was Tice's influence, because they were saying, oh, look at the map. It has this drawn here when we all know it's over here. You know, meanwhile, none of them have been there.
Right. One of the things I did like about the trial sequence, and I'm just a fan of this stuff now, is I've talked about this on the show before, is like I love old timey special effects, because now that we're just awash in CG, I like seeing the way guys had to do it practically. And there's all the scenes in the courtroom. There are long shots of hundreds of spectators. And, of course, they couldn't do that. They couldn't have that many people. I mean, in any given shot, you see for real probably 20 to 30 bystanders all in period costumes in the background. But that's probably all they could afford. But then you have shots of, like, Charles Coburn, when he's yelling at Spencer Tracy. And it's rear projection. And you see in the background, you know, hundreds of people, and they're all milling about and moving back and forth. I just love all that stuff because I just think it's so fun to look at, because you're like, wow, this is how these guys had to do it. You know, they were making this up as they went along. And the fact that it still looks so effective, I mean, it's slightly out of focus, the way your eye would look at something. It's you totally, I mean, it helps that it's in black and white as opposed to color. But I love seeing, I know that my eye can't help but notice it, but it doesn't take me out of the movie. Like, I just marvel at great matte paintings or great rear projection where it's like they really nail it. I'm like, these guys were such geniuses when you think about the level of the equipment they were working with in 1939.
Yeah, I agree. Also, just another aspect of that whole court, and it's, I mean, I know it's not court, but the whole courtroom scene was it gave Spencer Tracy a chance to emote a little bit and give his impassioned speech at the end, which I thought was very, very well delivered by him. And then it didn't work. So I thought that was cool. You know, because in you know, your typical Hollywood movie, he'd give his impassioned speech, and then one by one, everybody would stand up and start, you know, give a slow clap, and you know, he wins and gets carried off on everybody's shoulders.
Right. Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. he would learn to perfect that, because in later movies he would give the big speech and it would work. So he's honing his chops of how to give the big speech. And, you know, you can't go wrong handing Spencer Tracy a whole bunch of lines. You know, I mean, he's going to deliver them as effectively as possible because he was Spencer friggin' Tracy. You know, he just knew how to do it. So, yeah, it's a good movie. I don't think it's a great movie. I wouldn't put it in my top 10 Spencer Tracy movies of all time, but it's a solid adventure film. It's got a lot of neat stuff to it, some good performances. I love the old-timey actors. And, you know, it has Hollywood's as sort of close as they were going to get in 1939 to this real story. And I certainly said I learned more about Stanley Livingston from this movie than I ever did in real life. I think in history class we probably covered it for like 2 minutes. You know, it was like we had so much other things to cover. But here you get kind of a deep dive. And, again, I love watching Spencer Tracy. He's just always super fun. And it's, you know, a lot of his early films don't exist anymore. He did a lot of silent films and kind of lower budget films as he was coming up. And a lot of those movies are not around anymore. So before 1935, there isn't a whole ton of Spencer Tracy stuff around. So this is still one of the earlier films you were going to get to see him in before he got super old and craggy, started looking like The Thing. So I think that's going to do it for Stanley.
Wait! Don't end it yet.
Okay. Yes.
Because we have to. I don't care. I don't care that this is the Film and Water podcast.
Okay. Wow.
We have to answer the question.
What? Oh. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't even think about that. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
It's a crossover. I'm giving you my question.
All right. Fair enough.
And you know, I know you enjoy that. I give the Jaws scale on my show. I'm going to give it on your show. You know, if you're going to rank
it, this everybody, that you can see why we did not rehearse this.
Well, I did know I was going to ask you to rank it anyway. I thought
enough.
I was going to be able to do it in a nice, smooth segue.
Fair enough.
But you know, if a movie is ranked Jaws, we're saying it's an all-time classic movie, very few flaws, if any. If you rank it as Jaws 2, which is not how I rank Jaws 2, you're saying it's a really, really solid movie, worthy of multiple watchings, but not quite at the level of classic. Jaws 3, an enjoyable movie, but, you know, nothing particularly special. Jaws 4 is a bad movie. Again, that is not how I rank all the Jaws movies, with the exception of Jaws the first of the four. But where would you rank this on that scale?
I would give it a Jaws 2. I would say it's certainly no classic, but it's solid, and all the performances are top-notch. The effects worker is good. It's a real-life story brought to life very vividly, so I would give it a solid Jaws 2.
See, I'm in agreement with your description totally, but I do come down to, when I rank a movie Jaws 2, I think it has solid rewatchability, whereas I think this is one kind of where you watch it, you enjoy it, and then you put it in the bank and you don't, you know, like I don't see pulling this one out and saying, hey, let's watch Stanley and Livingston, you know, once every 2 or 3 years.
I agree with that.
So for that reason, I'm going to rank it as a high Jaws 3.
Okay. That's fair. I think it's reasonable. I was toggling between the two, but I think Jaws 3 is such garbage, I have a tough time assigning any movie.
Well, you did the Jaws program with me, and just to point out to your readers, I think we were pretty much in agreement. We both ranked Jaws as Jaws.
Yes.
We both ranked Jaws 2 as Jaws 3. And we both ranked Jaws 3 and Jaws 4 as Jaws 4.
Yes. I would. Yeah. As confusing as that sounds, yes, that is accurate.
So just saying it's Jaws 3 does not mean it's Jaws 3D.
That's, yeah. I would put it between, if we're never confusing people horribly. I would put it between, you said a high Jaws 3. I would give it like a little better than that, but right around there. I think that's a, I think that's a completely fair estimation.
All right. So, you know, I would say if somebody is a person who enjoys old movies, then this is absolutely worth sitting down and watching. If you're the kind of person who says, oh, that's in black and white, I don't want to watch it, then don't bother. You know, because you have, I think you have to have a feel for old time Hollywood to really appreciate this the way you should.
I would agree. I would think if watching old movies is tough for you, this probably doesn't have enough juice to really keep you interested the way like maybe a Humphrey Bogart movie would or some other Spencer Tracy movie. So, yeah, it's probably a little dry in some places, but I did enjoy watching it a second time. Like I said, I saw it once 25 years ago, but when I rewatched it, I was not bored or like, oh, when are we going to get through this? I actually did enjoy seeing it the second time.
Yeah, and same here. Well, it was only the first time for me, but I definitely enjoyed my time watching.
All right, well, very cool. Well, that is going to do it for Stanley Livingston, but you got to hold on because we are eventually going to do, when is it, a couple of weeks after this episode drops, Is It Jaws is going to come out with part two for talking about Bad Day at Black Rock. So where can, before until we get to that episode, where can people find Is It Jaws, Paul?
They could find it on iTunes, obviously. You just look up Is It Jaws. You could also find it at twotruefreaks.com.
All right, very cool. And, of course, you can find our show over on our network site, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're talking movies all the time over on Twitter, which is at filmandwaterpod. So, again, everybody look out. Keep an eye out for part two of this Spencer Tracy crossover over on Is It Jaws on the Two True Freaks Network. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Guides say that this lake is Tanganyika, this village Ujiji, Livingston's hiding place for which we have searched so long. It's hard to believe. I'm afraid it's only a feverish mirage and it will vanish before my eyes. After all these months of disappointments, can I dare believe that I have won? The next few moments will give me the answer. Dr. Livingston, I presume.